lips. So,
let me begin with a disclaimer before I undo it. The disclaimer is, of course, I would not want to argue that Hegel was not misogynist. That the evidence of the philosophy of right and the philosophy of nature would make that argument ludicrous. My claim, however, is that whatever his general misogyny, that there is no grounds for it in the phenomenology. That the argument of the phenomenology is one that requires, as I'm about to demonstrate, that Antigone be the heroine and a representative of the voice of individuality. So my claim, if you remember, was that in burying her brother, the grounds for that was that was the necessary act in order to retrieve his individuality, which had been sacrificed to the nation. And that the nation is, as a war machine, nothing but a system of sacrifice. And that the family enters into it to claim back and give the individual, in the rites of burial, a completeness to that individual life. And that furthermore, to get a twist, in the act of giving individuality its due, it becomes universal. Now what Hegel means by that, other than a funny kind of logical argument, is that it joins the community of the dead. And in the community of the dead is the community of the nation in its moment of passiveness. So only with burial does both the moment of individuality and the moment of universality get their proper place. What then is so Antigone? By being the voice of that, can only be the voice of that, not by simply doing her role-bound duty, which is what she does do. She can only do her role-bound duty by transgressing the law of the state. But the moment she transgresses the law of the state, namely the authority of Creon, do not bury any enemies of the state, she steps outside the family. She goes beyond her role-bound obligation. She individuates herself because she's gone beyond the role assigned to her, right? And becomes the voice of individuality, indeed a political voice. And as I suggested last time, and as Henry wrote about in that in the paper last year, there's all sorts of evidence in the text that the chorus takes her to be a political figure, right? And not just a voice of the family. That is, the citizens back her against Creon. For
for Creon they come to regard as a tyrant. Indeed, his son comes to regard him as a tyrant. So, my first thesis is that Antigone is the voice of suppressed individuality or singularity. So we need a bit of Hegelian logic here. Hegel operates with three logical categories: universal, particular, and singular. We all kind of know what universal is. So what's the difference between a particular and a singular? A particular is an individual who is wholly saturated in their social role. That is, it is an individual who appears as merely the bearer of a social role and has no identity independently of that social role. So, for example, when you go to church, as I know you all do, and go to confession, which I know you all do regularly, it doesn't matter who's on the other side of the screen, right? It is the priest, the individual in their role, that gives you absolution or condemns you to hell, whatever they do, right? And equally, right, when you come to me and I sign your forms, it's not because I'm a nice guy, it's because I'm the chair of the department. Right? Those are the kinds of acts of a particular and not an individual. So individuality is something that has its own moment for itself and not merely for another. And it's this I'm suggesting, right, for which the Greeks as yet had no notion. Right? So when, you know, people argue the Greeks had no notion of will, or they had no conception of subjectivity, what they mean is there were particulars, but no thick individuals. That is, people did not conceive, now we have to ask what that means, they did not conceive of their lives as having an interest, or a movement, or a significance apart from the roles they played within the larger society. So it's not as if, you know, they didn't have personalities, right? They had personalities, okay, but nonetheless, their weal and woe was role-bound. It's this that Antigone is the voice of. And Hegel is saying that it's the lack of it. So that's one side of his argument, is it's the lack of this that is the ultimate source of the necessary insufficiency of Greek ethical life. But his argument has another side. And the other side is where I'm going to claim it's explicit that the criticisms of him by feminists must be false. And that is, Hegel thinks that what generates what brings to a head the collision. I mean, after all, the notion of particular here, the notion of universal, means that we have nothing but, you know, human and divine law. Hegel says that the other feature of Greek ethical life, indeed the one that made it appear beautiful, is that this functional divide, these are simply two tasks that have to be carried out by the society. So these are both, if you want, these are both spiritual notions, right? You know, the divine and the human, right? Or family and state are both spiritual powers. What brings them finally into collapse is equally what makes the original image one of beauty. Namely, that who belongs to which side is dependent upon gender alone. That is, the human is male and the divine is female, which means, for Hegel, that what should be a fully spiritual structure is actually being determined by a naturally given fact, namely gender difference. Hegel agrees there's gender difference, arguing is that. What he's arguing against is, and I'm going to beat this to death by doing every passage where it says this, what he's arguing against is you cannot organize a spiritual totality on the basis of unmediated natural facts. That's the given. And therefore, it is a form of immediacy. Now, it's immediacy, he argues, the immediacy of the natural. So what he's claiming is what makes Greece look pretty, look beautiful, is what nowadays we would call a perfect structure of gender complementarity. Right? But that equally, gender complementarity, is what sinks it. And it sinks it precisely because it's natural and not spiritual. Right? So the fact that Greece is a culture that lacks individuality, this story, right? Remember last week I talked about a culture of reflection versus a culture of immediacy. The fact that it lacks individuality is actually dependent upon its deployment of nature to determine roles. That is, it could not have the immediacy that ignores the moment of individuality and operates merely with particularity unless it was structured, it took some natural fact of the matter, some feature of human anatomy. Could have been long noses and short noses. Not the one they used. And used that as a spiritual basis. Okay, so now let me give you the passages and beat this idea to death. Just so, I know everyone always thinks when I do this argument I'm making it up. But my argument again is that the old criticisms of Hegel are just consequences of not misreading, of simply not reading. It's just looking at the same three or four sentences and not looking at any other sentences. So, the bottom of paragraph 465, Hegel says,
The ethical consciousness, however, knows what it has to do and has already decided whether to belong to the divine or the human law. So here is, and I use this because this is the moment where there is no reflection. Right? Remember I said reflectiveness means you have to figure out what to do. You have to deliberate. But this is an occasion where there's no deliberation. Well, why don't you have to deliberate? Why don't you have to decide what to do? Because what you have to do is already determined by your anatomy. And that's what he goes on to say. The immediate firmness of decision is something implicit, and therefore has at the same time the significance of a natural being, as we have seen. Nature, not the accident of circumstances or choice, assigns one sex to one law, the other to the other law. Or conversely, the two ethical powers themselves give themselves an individual existence and actualize themselves in the two sexes. In paragraph 468, he is beginning to talk about the question of guilt and crime. And he's now going to say that the very thing that makes Antigone's action an action and not a deed, not just a doing, but a deed, right? What makes it a deed is that it transgresses a law, is criminal. Which is to say, what's important here? Antigone's action has a moment of negativity about it. But the negativity is not something she intends. The negativity, as it turns out, the very thing that gives that action its ethical weight and historical significance, the very thing, since we know negativity is necessary for individuality, the very thing that individuates her again turns out to be a consequence of nature. So he says, roughly in the middle of paragraph 468, middle of page 282, on the contrary, the action is itself this splitting into two. The action is what breaks up, fractures, or to use that Hegelian word, diremps the whole from itself. That you don't know what the whole really is until there's a deed. And the deed reveals the whole as always already antagonistic. But until that deed occurs, that diremption does not occur. It only occurs in the act in which there is a splitting because these things are shown not to be functionally cooperative, but shown to have a moment of antagonism. On the contrary, the action itself is splitting into this explicit self-affirmation. Notice. Self-affirmation is one of the Nietzschean language, right? So out of this world in which there were only role-bound duties, suddenly there is an act of self-affirmation. An establishing over against itself of an alien external reality, that there is such a reality, this stems from the action itself and results from it. So I take it the notion of self-affirmation is the claim that indeed it's Hegel who thinks that Antigone is establishing herself, right, as an individual, as something like a self. Right? As a relation. Why? Because She relates to herself via what she is not, right? By taking a stand on her difference from the world she inhabits, and therefore not merely being a role bearer. Innocence, therefore, is merely non-action, like the mere being of a stone. That's his judgment of Ismene. Ismene, she's innocent, all right, the way a stone is innocent, right? Not even that of a child. As regards content, however, the ethical action contains the moment of crime because it does not do away with the natural allocation of the two laws to the two sexes. So it's a crime because it fails to overcome this duality and, in fact, insist upon it. Right? But rather, being an undivided attitude towards the law remains within the sphere of natural immediacy, and qua action turns this one-sidedness into guilt by seizing on only one side of the essence and adopting a negative attitude towards the other, that is, violating it. The place in the universal ethical life of guilt and crime, of deeds and actions, will find more definite expression later. About 300 pages later. Chapter on conscience. But clearly, I mean, the reason Hegel's flagging this is because he thinks that there is something about the nature of action itself that is at stake in the notions of crime, guilt, and transgression, and evil. That these are not notions that merely represent, and I want to be absolutely clear, these notions cannot merely represent privations of the good. That they have to have more depth, more significance, to be in the very nature of the action, and not just a failure of action. So if, after all, to put it another way, if Antigone is the heroine here, she's only a heroine by being a criminal. And that must tell us something about what we think, right? It is to do a significant action in general. And this is what I tried to indicate last week when I mentioned again that Hegel's three models of significant agents are Jesus, Socrates, and Antigone. Three, civil disobedience. So when we get to conscience, I'm going to try to claim that civil disobedience is in some way for Hegel exemplary of significant action in general. It's actually his model for the meaning of action. Which is a large, perhaps foolish promise. In paragraph 473, here, still on page 285, Hegel says, I'll be quick on this one, on the one side of the content it is the clash between divine and human law, the youth comes away from the unconscious spirit of the family and becomes the individuality of the community, but that he still belongs to the nature from which he wrenched himself free is evidenced by the fact that he emerges in the contingent form of two brothers, each of whom with equal right take possession of the community
the inequality of the earlier and later birth, an inequality which is a natural difference, has no importance for them when they enter the ethical life of the community. So he's saying, again, against, I suppose this is about Polynices and Tuckleys, this whole thing turns on who came out of the womb before who. That's another example of nature determining the structure of spirit, which here is what generated the war. This was the crowd of the war, the seven against Thebes, right? The disinherited brother, Polynices, is going to, try to get back, his place in the Theban community and take it over and inherit the throne. It's not my fault that my father brother was Oedipus. Okay, I talked about paragraph 475 last time. So my thesis about the ignominious paragraph 475 is that very passage that is the source of the indictment against Hegel is Creon's voice. It's Creon's argument, above all, Creon's argument over and over again against Haemon in their dialogue, right, from about line 600 following. Keeps claiming that the problem with Haemon is he is being driven by a woman, that womankind is diverting the ends of the state towards private self-interest. That is Creon's argument against Haemon. Hegel repeats that argument and then goes on to say, that's right, because womankind here, in exactly the ways I began with, is the voice of individuality. Right? If there had been no women, what would we have? And he tells us in this very paragraph, nothing but people going to war, right? And young men being sacrificed to the state. Boom, gone. No individuality whatsoever. So it's not an accident that at the end of paragraph 475, he goes into the whole story about war again. And that war... Yeah, and the unburied dead will, undo the state. Finally, the final paragraph, he repeats the nature argument, only now he says explicitly that it's the thesis about nature that is the source of the illusory beauty of Greek ethical life. So, second sentence, this determination of immediacy means that nature as such enters into the ethical act, the reality of which simply reveals the contradiction and the germ of destruction inherent in the beautiful harmony and tranquil equilibrium of ethical spirit itself. For this immediacy has the contradictory meaning of being unconscious tranquility of nature and also the self-conscious restlessness of spirit. Etc. Now, one can deepen this thought by thinking a bit further about what the argument of the structure of the play is like. And here I want to follow the account that is both in H.S. Harris's book, his long commentary,
but also in Kimberly Hutchins' book on Hegel and feminism. What is routinely ignored in most accounts of Antigone is that the divine law
is, of course, I suggested, the law of the particular. But I also said to you that when we bury the dead, they join the universal, and this is what Hegel says, community of the dead.
Well, what universal community? Well, I think the argument here is that the household and the ethical identity of its members through the divine law belongs to the Greek community as a whole beyond the specific polis. That is, the divine law is the law of something as Greek, irrespective of which particular Greek polis or tribe. So, in a sense, the divine law is more universal than the human law because it belongs to the whole of Greece. And it makes the city a particular. Conversely, let us remember who Creon is. Creon rules Thebes because he is Jocasta's brother. And Jocasta, just to remind you, was Oedipus's wife. Right? So, roughly when all the bad things happened to Oedipus, right, the next in line turned out not to be his children. They were cursed with him. So the rulership went across to Creon. Right? The king's, queen's brother. Which is to say that his kingship depends on family. That he is part of the Theban royal family, and he's, in fact, the closest relative to the dead brothers, apart from Antigone herself and Ismene. So, like the dead brothers who are fighting to inherit the kingship, he also inherited his position. So the entire public sphere here is contaminated by natural blood relationships. It is not some pure, free idea of pure democratic nationhood. So, to put it in a paradoxical formulation, Creon ignores the claims of the ties of blood on which he is nonetheless dependent. Conversely, Antigone's crime ignores the dependency of the divine, of the family, on human law. In fact, you put it another way. It's like Hannah Arendt's arguments about rights. Right? In The Origins of Totalitarianism, Arendt says, when you become a stateless person, and someone says to you, yeah, but you have human rights,
friend says, great. What use are human rights without a state to back them up? That is, human rights need any rights, Arendt argues, are idle, empty, useless, probably unreal, unless they are embodied in positive rights of a state which enforces them.
So the identity of Polynices as Greek is not a free-floating fact. It depends on him being Theban. That is, you can't just belong to a people, you've got to belong to a people with a particular political organization. This means that the divine and human are not that different structurally. Both, as Hegel says, in a sense, include the whole, but are hence equally one-sided. And they're one-sided again because nature infects both with an unacknowledged contingency and indeed a naive assumption that life can overcome or sublate death. Recognize the natural ground of passiveness of all community. Okay, now, the immediate consequence of this for a theory of action, let me stop there before saying that theory of action. Any questions about this kind of reading of what Hegel's up to here?
I've been bludgeoning you.
So just some pointers forward to what I claimed when we began this will be Hegel's conception of the role of retrospection in the theory of action. That is, I began by arguing that part of what's at stake here in Antigone's deed, the doing of something that sets things in motion, right, is we're going to generate a cartesianist retrospective account of the meaning of action. And what I mean by that is the claim that what an action is and how it can be mine are comprehensible only through the action itself and what transpires from it. And in saying that, I am arguing against the thesis that because we have prior intentions, and indeed we have a privileged access to what our intentions are, that those intentions or that privileged access determine the meaning and mindness of the action. That is our spontaneous and natural liberal belief. And it's just that that Hegel means to be undermining here. So, for me to know what I have done,
I have to see what happens.
That Antigone, and Antigone's action here is one in which she intends,
really, the burying of her brother and the following of law.
She knows, of course, that she's breaking the law that Creon set up. What she does not know, and she admits to not knowing fully, although she never admits guilt, is whether she was right or wrong. So she says, I mean, Hegel, by the way, famously misquotes Sophocles. Sophocles has Antigone say, "In suffering, I'll see my action clear." Hegel turns this into, "Because we suffer, we acknowledge we have erred."
And very often, hang around Hegelians long enough, you'll think that that's what Sophocles said.
Sophocles, suffering, you're guilty. But what Hegel does want to say is even for Antigone, she gains more and more insight into what she has done and what its stakes are through what happens. Right? That her knowledge of her, the very thing she has done occurs after the act of burial, through the arguments with Creon, through the backing of the citizens, through the response of Haemon, and so on and so forth. Secondly, is the issue of knowing why one does something. Now, on the one hand, and here's the question of, let's call it, desire formation. And this has two sides. First, we must come to recognize that our desires are not given, but formed in a personal and collective history. Indeed, formed in part by the structures of society we inhabit. You know, you don't just happen to have the desire to bury your brother. You have that desire only in light of a certain desire formation. So having a desire means coming to acknowledge that formation and taking responsibility for it. That is, it's not merely, oh, the law made me do it. That's exactly what Antigone doesn't do. Rather, she says, that was my duty. I was determined with that desire. And further, I freely acknowledge it. I take a stand on it. And I'd rather die, literally, than to disavow it. So, the thought here, then, is the why of an action is something both in me and not in me, something formed. And the two must be brought together for the desire to become my desire. And often, again, that occurs through retrospection. That is, it's only when I become clear because of the consequences of the action that I have to take a stand on the action or disavow it. Now, that's what I'm being asked to do. Can I actually figure out what the desire was
and what my relationship to it was, and hence whether or not I want to call it mine. The mindness of an action doesn't come from me initially doing it. It's again a retrospective taking responsibility for it. So responsibility and regret and agent identity come about through the identifying with or taking a stand on actions, which means on their consequences. And hence, it's through that secondary feature, the taking of a stand, that actions come to have what I'm going to call later on an expressive dimension. That is, that they express who I am. That is, the reason why Hegel says that Antigone's act is an act of self-affirmation is because she stakes herself, her identity, who she is, on the doing of that action. Right? So no action need have all those consequences. Again, you know, Antigone could have done it, and then Creon said, you really shouldn't have done it, and she goes, you're right. Silly me. Come on, Ismene, let's go bake a cake. Right? Now, the point here is who she is different because of her retrospective relationship to the action. So, agent identity is not something that is determined prospectively, but only in the retrospective relation to the full consequences of the action as that action is played out in relationship to the rest of the community. Sure.
Rather than be determined just by the agent's retrospective reflection on the action, isn't the accusation, for example, from Creon or from others and so forth, who say, did you not do this? And that it's only in response, because I do not deny I did what I, you know, I did
right.
And so forth, that gets, so it shouldn't say, by the way, I did it, I do not deny that I did it.
Right.
So, it's not just, in other words, not a biographical reflection on one's own.
Oh, no, this isn't going home and thinking about it.
Right.
bury your brother, go home, what did I do today? No, when I say it's the relation of the consequences, I mean the whole set of consequences, including that one is called to account, is called guilty or called innocent, right? It's all of that. And so the retrospection is in part process. It's the continuing way in which you relate to the action, and that is in part what determines what the action was and its mindness. So mindness turns out to be a complicated social practice. I think this is, let's stop for a second and think about other accounts of mindness, right? Usually, an action is mind because if you're an analytic philosopher, because you have a belief and a desire, and they hook up, and that's it. So it's just a belief-desire set that happens to happen to this body. That's the mindness of an action. Or the mindness of an action occurs because you did it intentionally, right? That you acted with purpose. Kant began to worry about the mindness of an action. And he was worried that, well, how do I know that my desires are mine? Right? Kant insisted over and over again, this way Kant is very Freudian. He kept saying, we actually don't know what our desires or motives are. So what we need to do to make them mine is to take
something and treat it as the reason for my action. So it's not the having of a desire that makes it a reason for action.
It's taking that desire
and saying that it trumps every other desire, and furthermore, and now here's the real bit for me, I can be certain that I am not being determined by that desire if it's compatible with the moral law. The moral law is what lifts action out of nature and makes the idea that it is truly mine and not the voice of nature speaking through me the action. So mindness for Kant turns out to be the same as free, and free only if done in accordance with the moral law. Heidegger has a different worry about mindness. Right? He is worried that when I'm acting, it's really das Mann who's acting. I think I'm talking about Antigone, but it's really, you know, this group and that group. And in order for me to be really talking about Antigone, for my actions here to be mine, I have to have a being towards death. Right? Because only a being towards death, death is the non-substitutable relation, you know, to the random nothingness on which I stand, individuates me. So the whole question of being in time is really about the mindness of action. And my view about the Heideggerian analysis is, it's a bit of magic. Right? Just think about my death and how I will make it mine. I don't have to do anything else. Well, no, it's a form. I wanted to put it this way, because like Kant, it's a formalism. Right? The notion of authenticity is it's a form or a manner. Being towards death is a certain attitude or relation. But none of them have what I'm calling necessary, namely the full weight of retrospectivity. Right? What they all want, and this is the delusion, they all want to be certain now that my action is mine. Heidegger, of all people, tries to empty action of its inherent quality of being a synthesis of the temporal modalities. Right? He wants to, as it were, sew up the future here and now. Can't be done.
So this is going to be, I want to suggest, a continuing weight on how we can have a theory of action which has the weight of retrospectivity, and what kind of, and this is, I take Hegel's question, what kind of community must we inhabit if this is going to run?
All of this, he thinks, is implied by Antigone. Antigone introduces the notion of a different notion of action. And after all, just think about it in terms of not in a complex way, but we often talk about tragic irony. Things happening as the reverse of what was anticipated. Now our notion of tragedy is exactly about the way in which we cannot understand action through the notion of control. That tragedy is an awareness of the depth of human experience that exceeds our powers of control and how we are called to take responsibility for what we did not intentionally do. And of course, that's the way the retrospective theory of action is going to differ from the liberal theory of action. And this is something that Hegel beats to death, ironically, in his aesthetics more than anywhere else. The liberal notion of action, and Hegel says, you know, we probably need this for our courts and law, and we're only responsible for what we intend. And other things are just, you know, we could not foresee them, and we're not responsible. Oedipus. Never intended to commit parricide or incest. But he takes complete and absolute responsibility. There is nothing he could have done to foresee those actions. No bit of deliberation, no bit of... He didn't lack some knowledge he should have had. He wasn't drunk when he killed his... None of that. No excuses, right? That are of a reasonable kind. But he was completely ignorant of what he was doing, and you might say that is mitigating. He does not accept the mitigation for a second. He thinks that is what he did, and therefore he must take full responsibility.
But can we draw that comparison between Oedipus and, say, a contemporary theory of action when Oedipus's relationship towards his guilt is in some sense conditioned by the preconception of, like, role-bound identity, which doesn't have its...
It's not going to matter because, I mean, where the debates happen, the famous debate in Anglo-American theories of action is over the role of moral luck. And
Bernard Williams and Thomas Nagel have kind of famous debate about this, and the debate's been rumbling on.
But the argument is really about what the significance of consequences are for us as agents. So even if there are unforeseen consequences, the Hegelian argument is, in some sense, I may not be legally responsible, but I will be responsible. And to disown responsibility is simply to try to chop my action up into its intended bits and its unintended bits, as if action don't always, routinely, have unintended consequences. But if actions routinely have unintended consequences, then we can't have a theory of responsibility, above all a theory of moral responsibility, that's simply narrowly based in intention. So, I do something, I didn't intend harm, I cause harm, I try to make reparations. I apologize. I couldn't see that coming, but I'm really sorry. Is there any way I can make it up to you? The fact that I don't intend it doesn't stop me being connected to those consequences. Right? That is, as it were, only someone who was worried about, you know, a litigious society in which they want to disclaim as much responsibility as they can and don't want to get sued for anything, is going to have a good reason to try to draw the line in that hard and fast way. And I'm suggesting to you, it's inhuman. It's not the way we're connected to one another. Right? If every time I did something, I mean, we all exist in close, we have friends, lovers, we do unintended wrongs all the time. We apologize, not because we've done wrong, but because we've caused harm. Right? The causing harm is enough for us to apologize. If you say, look, I'm sorry it was your favorite dress, or I'm sorry. I burnt it. I'm sorry. It'll never happen again. But I didn't mean it. Tough luck. Something's gone wrong here. Something's gone wrong. So we have, and it's very hard. Hegel is really asking us to think differently about how we identify an individuated action. And he's saying we can't lock it in. Yep.
I mean, this just to pick up on that thought, though, I mean, it's interesting that if and I think it's right that Hegel has tragedy in mind here. Tragedy is a discourse that's apology-free. I mean, so it's not as though, so I mean, I understand, of course, that apology would be a way of understanding how our actions have unintended consequences, but that doesn't seem to be what's at stake in Oedipus or Antigone. That it's not about an acknowledgement of guilt or admission of responsibility or any of these things, although I see how those are different from other theories of action that, in the way that Hegel says. Instead, it seems, if I'm right, I mean, partly, just even looking at Aristotle, it has to do with the way in which one owns up to one's story, to one's history. Without, and simply that, so not for the sake of responsibility, not for the sake of exculpation, not for the sake of excusing oneself to one's loved ones or anything like that.
Right.
You know, I tell you, Oedipus doesn't say sorry, kids. You know, you know, it's
on the contrary.
Right. On the contrary. So.
But you know, he does tear his eyes out.
He
feels bad. So I'm suggesting, and of course, not all the elements of the story are available.
And then Antigone walking around. I mean, it's a,
right. Yeah. No, not all the elements of the story are available here, which is why the book can end here, right? So we don't have all the elements for a full retrospective theory of action. What tragedy does is underline how deeply unintended consequences belong to an action and can't be thought of as a category apart. If they're a category apart, then again, there's no tragedy. There's just a lot of people going to the courts all the time. Just a crazy litigious society. Okay, let's... can see your pondering. So keep pondering. Let's have a little break, and we'll quickly do the Roman world and the absolutist state, and we'll do a whole bunch of stuff quick. We're getting way behind.
We're getting way behind. We're probably way behind.